From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh.
I just wish it didn't come to this point. You know, if we had got 100 volunteers, we wouldn't be here. And I'm hoping that, we can move beyond it.
We'll talk with him about police body cams, about schools, and he'll take your questions. Also today...
Your backup quarterback staying in your place, that's an issue. I mean, to me, you're telling me that my position as a backup quarterback and being quiet is more important than people's lives.
We'll talk about NFL players protesting during the national anthem and the rest of the week's sports news with Bill Littlefield. Plus, the resentencing of convicted murderer Gary Lee Sampson.
They're going to be presenting a lot more evidence that they've picked up since the last trial to make the case with the jurors that his future dangerousness should lead them to calling for the death penalty.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to start today with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. He's in the studio live to take your questions at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. There's also a Facebook live feed of our conversation going on right now. That's at facebook.com/Radio Boston. And if you go there, you can see that the mayor is dressed in his usual professional attire, whereas I am wearing some WBUR swag today. Mr. Mayor, it's great to see you again. Thanks so much.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's dive right in and talk about the Boston Police body cam pilot program. We're in day three now.
Day three, yeah.
107 Boston police officers are wearing body cameras. But obviously, it's been very contentious getting to this point. Do you worry about the overall success of the pilot program, given the fight that it's taken to get even this far?
No, I'm certainly not concerned about the success of what we find. I mean, we're going to be using this data and take the information we find on the street and the data we find and see if we institute a full body camera program in the city. I think the fight that happened was really the leadership of the union that felt that they had to go to court. I wish they didn't have to do that because certainly we take pride in Boston and the policing, the relationship between the community. And by just even thinking about going to court or actually taking us to court, I think it sent the wrong message. But the judge ruled in the city's favor and the commissioner's favor. And from that point on, we have a full program. I'll be honest with you. I went over to the officers the day that they were being trained before the lawsuit was heard, and a lot of the officers, particularly the newer officers, said, "There's no problem with this." Mm. They go, "We're used to this stuff with cameras and with iPhones and all the other stuff." So, we can't let it. We can't dwell on the issue of the lawsuit. We got to move beyond it because we've done some great things in our city.
Well,
we're going to continue to do great things.
What about the impact that the fight over, just even getting the pilot program off the ground? What about the impact that's having or has had on community relations between the BPD and the community? I mean, I want to just play a quick piece of tape here for you to that effect, because we spoke last month with Michael Curry, president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP, and here's what he had to say.
For anyone who believes that we do community policing here so well that there's no tension between communities of color and police officers, they are not walking the streets of Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan. The tension exists here. It is better than many other places. But in one incident, we could turn into a Baltimore, Ferguson. I don't make that up. Any leader in the community will tell you the same thing.
Do you think that there's that much tension out there between community members and the Boston police?
I don't think it's as tense as might have been referenced in that piece that Michael said, but there is definitely tension out there in the communities in certain neighborhoods. There's going to be tension wherever you go with police community relations. It doesn't matter whether it's Boston or Baltimore or San Francisco or anywhere across America, and we got to constantly work at that. And I think that that's what the concern with the resistance of the program was, the body camera program was going to court by the head of the unions. I was concerned about that. But now that the program is out on the street, we're gonna continue to move forward on it and see what the result of that is. And I don't think, I said this in the beginning, body cameras can't build trust in a community. They're there to take a film, an interaction. What builds trust in a community, what Michael Curry was talking about, I think, and what we talk about, is actually interaction with the community, with young people in the office, in the community. That's what we need, the officers in the community to interact. You can't have interaction through a camera, and you can't have it. You have to have it through dialogue.
I got to say, though, you know, a little earlier you were saying we're doing great things in Boston. We'll continue to do so. But nationally, I can't recall a fight of this nature over getting even a pilot program for police body cams off the ground. I mean, what does it say about what's going on here in Boston difficult?
I wouldn't say it was such a fight. I mean, it went to court. Yeah, of course it went to court, and a lot of things go to court. But we negotiated a contract leading up to it, and then after we negotiated that contract, I think that certain people, and I'm not even sure if it's the person who signed that letter that you have in front of you, I think that some of the delegates that are part of the union leadership get concerned. I think what they have to do, honestly, is have more conversations with us, with the commissioner and myself about how we move forward. We're going to continue to move forward with making changes within the police department and positive changes and continually not forcing, we shouldn't have to force, but continuing making sure that there's community relations happening all day long. This is a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week job that we have to do to make sure that we continue to build trust in the community.
So this letter that you're referencing that I've got here in front of me, it's an undated letter that was made public last month that was addressed to you and Police Commissioner Bill Evans, and it came from several of the Boston police unions.
Yeah, three of them.
Three of them. And in it, I mean, it was a very emotional, strongly worded letter that you said originally had you were quite taken aback by the language. Yep. Because they called for several things, demanding the use of long guns, also demanding things like body armor and extra water and
helmets,
ballistic helmets.
Yep.
And they said they demand it for, they believe, their own safety. What I wanted to ask you, I mean, you have commented before about it, but I wanted to ask you specifically about one particular line, because it references something you just said, because you said there should be more conversations between you and the police unions. But in that letter, they said, sometimes we feel that we are not being taken seriously. I mean, what is the relationship between you and the unions now?
I mean, I think we're in the midst of negotiation with all four police unions. I would say I have a good relationship with the unions, but it's really with the membership of those unions and the leadership on that letter. I think that this letter, some of the things in the letter I agreed with, and we are concerned about obviously the safety of the officers, and we've been able to make some adjustments there, and Commissioner Evans and myself and Chief Willie Gross. I think that's rhetoric in a union. As a former union president, you have to put that in there and stir the pot a little bit. And I think it's sometimes that language is unnecessary and unneeded.
Well, let me just offer you another little bit of tape here. This is from former Boston Police Superintendent in Chief Dan Linsky. He was on our show not long after the letter was made public to give his perspective, again, as a former BPD Superintendent in Chief. And here's what he had to say about the demands regarding equipment that the unions were making in this letter to you.
Giving police officers a sense of safety so that they weren't fearful when they're in the community trying to deal with those issues would be helpful. The last thing we want is police who are fearful of community and community who's fearful of police who are going to encounter each other at 911 calls and events in the neighborhood.
So just your response to that. I mean, again, this is specifically related to the calls for equipment that they made.
The calls for equipment that the unions made in this letter go back 4 years. Danny Linsky was the superintendent in chief back then. So I think that we're working towards some solutions on getting the equipment finally to the officers and to the superior officers that they've been asking for. This is not the first time that, in my understanding, that they've been asking for upgrade equipment. It goes back before I was the mayor and before Billy Evans was the commissioner. So I think that we're going to continue to work, and some of those concerns in that letter have been addressed already. In the process of being addressed, we're going to continue to address them.
Which ones in particular?
Having more ammunition and more guns with our superior officers to have a little more firepower out there in the case we need them. We're not going to have police officers walking around the streets of Boston with long rifles. That's just not going to happen. But we are working on the helmets also, working to make sure that our officers have helmets in the case of, God forbid, a situation in the armor. We're looking at the cost of all those as well. And what do we bring into our office? So we've addressed some of those concerns.
Well, back to the body cams for a second. So again, we're in day three of the pilot program.
Yep.
When do you think, you know, you're saying that they're collecting data. When might the public be able to see some of that data?
I mean, I think within the next couple months. I don't think the public's actually going to see video video of somebody walking down the street. I mean, that's not the intent of the body camera. And people might say, well, we want to see that. In the case of an incident, you might see that. But I don't think we're just going to be randomly YouTubing a whole bunch of video that our officers are collecting on there. The cameras are there. We're going to be taking the information that we have in what we're finding, talking to the officers, talking to the superiors, talking to the community to see what some of the experiences are. I'd say we need at least a good 6 to 8 weeks of collection of some information to be able to kind of see where we go with this. And I think we'll start to have these dialogues probably in a couple months.
Well, we're talking with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh about a whole host of issues, from police body cams. We'll talk about schools and other ballot questions facing voters this November. If you have a question for Mayor Walsh, call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. There's a Facebook live feed going on as well. That's at facebook.com/Radio Boston. And you can also send us a tweet if that's your thing. Send the tweet to @Radio Boston. Let's turn quickly to West Roxbury. That's where Andrea is calling from. You're on the air, Andrea.
Hey, Mayor Walsh. My name's Andrea, and I live in West Roxbury, and I really support so much of what you've been doing over this, you know, since you've been. I know it's a very hard job, but I live about a block away from the proposed Spectra AIM metering and regulating station that's almost about to be built. And I understand that there was a safety meeting called by Spectra, and none of the local delegation was invited. And then they canceled the meeting, and now it's back on. And I'm just wondering if you know anything about it, since clearly with super high pressure, it's, you know, we're really concerned because it's supposedly a 30-block incineration zone possibility.
I personally don't know anything about the safety meeting, but I will look into it. Andrea, if you call the Office of Neighborhood Services, I'm sure they might already know about it, but I'll do some work on this afterwards. Spectra, this is a big issue in West Roxbury. There's been a lot of discussion on the radio here, I think, about it. Certainly myself and Congressman Lynch and Eddie Coppinger and Matt O'Malley and Mike Rush have gotten together. This is supported by FERC. FERC gave the approval to put a pipeline in and tie it into a facility that's next door as a blasting facility of quarry. So we're in court now again with this company trying to appeal the decision by the judge to stop the connection here. I know there's been a whole bunch of folks out there doing protesting in the streets
constantly,
every single day. And we're still waiting to get our appeal from FERC. We appealed FERC's decision as well to approve this. So we're trying to see where we can go with this thing. A lot of concern out in the community, though.
All right. Well, Mayor Walsh, let's move to the ever-important issue of public education in Boston, because yesterday, as you know, here on Radio Boston, along with the Globe and UMass Boston, we had a very spirited debate about question two, and that's the question about whether or not to expand the number of charter schools in Massachusetts. Now, you support charter schools as a whole, but you don't support question two. You're going to vote against it?
Yes, I'm voting against question two because it doesn't deal with the funding mechanism of charter schools. And I know yesterday part of that came up. Quite honestly, the city of Boston right now, we paid out of our budget this year about $19 million in an underfunded charter school line item by the legislature. There doesn't seem to be any appearance in sight to fully fund that bottom line item. Next year, we're looking at a $25 million shortfall for the city of Boston alone. There's about 11 cities and towns in the situation that we're in. We can't afford, in some cities and towns around Boston and Massachusetts, I should say, can't afford to be paying underfunded charter school line item reimbursements. They just can't do it. Now, we have the ability in Boston. We're a big, big entity. But even that, you saw the discussion. Yeah. We had over $5 million this year in the budget. Every dollar counts, and it just makes it very difficult. And there's no funding mechanism in this ballot initiative that deals with that question.
Well, I'm going to get to the funding mechanism issue in just a second. But yesterday, I mean, we heard from Yes on Two people say that on the face of it, with a $1 billion budget for BPS, for Boston Public Schools, that the idea that Boston can't pay for it, they find that argument to be ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, I'm a founding board member of Neighborhood House Charter School. If I were a charter school proponent, which I am, this ballot question would concern me, because you're talking about if the way the legislation is written, it would be 12 new charter schools a year in perpetuity here in Massachusetts. So eventually, we're going to run out of we don't need all these schools. 12 new schools. Let's assume 6 come into Boston. Those six schools need six buildings. Those six new schools need six boards of directors or trustees, if you will, they call them. I just don't see where all the money is going to come to support all of these different types of schools in the city, in the city of Boston, never mind around the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I think there's an opportunity. We had an opportunity through the legislative process to raise the number of charter school seats in Massachusetts in a very moderate way to do it.
Which failed. I mean,
which didn't move anywhere in the legislature. Yeah. But historically has been done in the legislature. So I don't understand why all of a sudden now we need, because it failed in the legislature one time, we go automatically to the ballot petition.
Well, because people are frustrated, but it was
the first time.
From the hundreds, if not thousands, of families who want to get into charter schools.
It was the first time ever that that happened. I mean, I was in. We previously, when I was in the legislature, we had three cap lifts or two cap lifts, which I supported, and then this is the first time that the cap didn't get lifted. It got lifted in the House, but not the Senate. Well, that just means more work has to be done, and a better bill has to be crafted. You have to work to it. And by just arbitrarily going to the ballot now, what's going to happen is if this passes, it's 12 schools. It's a big financial burden. To go back to the $1 billion for the city of Boston, we have 128 schools. We have 57,000 kids in our district. Our school budget is $1,034,000,000 this last fiscal year. $19 million of it was for charter school reimbursement. Plus, I don't have the figure of the transportation costs for transporting charter school kids. That's a lot of money if we're not getting fully reimbursed from the state. So anyone who makes an insinuation that the city has the money, they're just dead wrong. And I know that the people that were debating us, I think Marty Walsh, who's my friend and former colleague, when she knows that. She was the chair of education.
She's the one who made that argument.
Yeah, and she was the chair of education in the House of Representatives when we had the education reform bill, and knows exactly that this, the legislature doesn't always fully fund a Boston-based, whether it's Chapter 70 funding or it's charter school reimbursement.
But they were
funding.
Also looking at the annual rise in the BPS budget.
And there's a lot of big costs in there. You can't just arbitrarily stop paying for something. You know, we have issues in transportation. We had this battle last year. Myself and the counselor had this battle somewhat public this year, but we both have the same goal to get to fully funding our schools. But how do we get there? The costs are going to continue to go up every year. But when you look at a charter school cost going up $25 million next year, that's a lot of money.
Yeah. Do you have a concern about, I mean, some other people have raised the concern about this number of like 12 additional charter schools in Massachusetts, basically annually in perpetuity. I mean, you did.
In underperforming districts, by the way.
They would be prioritized.
And we are underperforming district because of our size and the amount of kids we have. And that's another disadvantage we have here in the city, that we would have, you know, I would like to be able to work with the state and see how many actual schools are we going to put online here. Because we currently have schools, two being run by the state. One is the Dever and one is the Holland, that we're kind of looking to see what's happening there. They took over our schools because they were underperforming. And we clearly know what the Dever is, they're not performing even now that the state's had them in a 2-year turnaround plan. So we have some work to do. We have some work to do when it comes to education.
Well, you know, there's a lot of outside money on both sides of this question coming into the state. You know, we saw that with the most recent filings from groups on Yes on Two and No on Two. Does that concern you at all?
It does, because in Massachusetts, for the most part, largely, we've seen independent charter schools come up in our city, in our state. So whether it's Neighborhood House Charter School, Conservatory Lab Charter School, or Boston Collegiate, they're not part of a bigger system. What's happening is a lot of the money, I think, that's coming into Massachusetts now in this ballot question is these multi, you know, large chain type of charter school shops. That concerns me. You see some of these down in New Orleans and other places. Down there, the battle with charter schools and public schools is so volatile. It's just, you know, charter schools are basically completely taking over the system, and public education is pretty much gone down there. That doesn't have to be the case here in Massachusetts. There's a way for us to both coexist. But I think with this big money that's coming in from outside the state, it's going to frighten people. It's going to say, well, there's a lot on the line here if these companies are bumping in millions of dollars.
But I keep coming back to this thought about all those families who are waiting, who are on those charter school waiting lists, and who you know, probably are yelling at their radio right now saying, fine, Mr. Mayor, but I can't. I don't want to have to wait another year, another 2 years to get my kid into a school that teaches him or her at the level that they deserve.
But those same parents that are yelling at the radio would also be pleased with the city of Boston turning around our Boston public school system so that we give every child an opportunity for a good, strong education. Many of our schools, all of our schools in kindergarten, first, second, third grade, fourth, fifth grade, are strong schools in our city. We're performing at high levels. It's where we start to lose our kids is for some parents have to take their kids out in fifth grade if they don't get into one of the exam schools. If they don't know test in, they take them out of the district. We have to keep our kids in the district, keep our kids in the schools. We have some great schools in the city of Boston as well that compete right next to our charter school. So I think some of the parents that have their children on a waiting list, I think they're starting to see changes in Boston Public Schools where they're willing to say, okay, what's happening over there? And that's ultimately what our goal is, myself and Superintendent Chang.
Well, what about this? A Boston Municipal Research Bureau report back in April of this year, a lot of people paid attention to this report because it did call for some school closings in Boston. And there's a particular quote from the report here. The true impact of Commonwealth charter schools on the BPS or Boston Public Schools lies in BPS's failure to reduce excess seats in a timely manner and its responsibility to provide transportation services to charter school students. Your response?
Yeah, I mean that report. The one thing there's a couple of things in that report. One, it talks about closing schools. We're not there yet. We still have some more work to do to see where we have to make some adjustments in our system. When I say closing, I don't know if we're ever going to. There's going to be more merging of schools than actually closing of schools, I think, if we ever get to this point. Secondly, is you know, we are doing a program right now called Build BPS, where we're doing an assessment of all of our mm-hmm. schools. When we get that assessment, we'll have a true understanding of do we have 93,000 seats available, and we have 57,000 kids in them.
Well, that's according to that McKinsey report.
We're gonna find, when we do this report, when we get this Build BPS back with all of the space we have in the schools, we're gonna have a real accurate assessment of what we have for schools.
Because I think this summer, from April through June or something, the 108 site visits were done.
I've been out there checking where we have for space, what our space is, and we really have to get this program. This is something I spoke about when I was a candidate for mayor and looking at, do we need the school building authority for Boston to be able to build some new schools in our city? So that's going to be with the most accurate account of where we have seats and where we have space available, because seats are changing too. Some schools you don't have the desks as much anymore, mm-hmm. so you have space. So it's really about the space.
Yeah. So let me ask you. Let's go back to the funding issue for just a second here, because you know, and I feel like no matter what happens in November over question two, whether it passes or not, I mean, you're even critical of the status quo when it comes to funding.
Yeah.
And where the money goes regarding charter schools. I was looking at something that you said not that long ago, that you eventually hope to persuade legislators to shift the burden of those initial charter school expenses to the state entirely?
Yeah, and when charter schools were created, there was a line item that went along with them. Charter schools are licensed by the state, and they're inspected by the state, and it's a state entity, and what should happen, basically, it's a state school system for them, all intents and purposes. The funding works through cities and towns.
Right.
So we have zero, when I say this city of Boston has zero say, and nor should we, in how to operate a charter school. We shouldn't have that say in how to operate a charter school. However, the state, if the state funded these schools directly and took the burden off the city, that's $19 million more this year in this fiscal year that we're in now.
So you'd like the state to do that for the first year, for the first 5 years?
For the entire time of charter school being open, because they opened the school. So basically create a charter school district and fully fund that district through the legislative appropriation.
So you want the state to fully fund charter schools
Absolutely.
In perpetuity?
Because
how is the state going to pay for that?
Because we have to fully fund our public school system.
So you want the state to fund, but it would essentially be creating its own state K-12 system.
K-12 system. And the kids, the money that they're getting, the money that same as what we do, except we're paying for larger, we're getting less and less reimbursement, Chapter 70 now in the city. So we're paying more and more out of our real estate taxes.
Is this idea getting any traction amongst your former colleagues on Beacon Hill?
Probably about 10 cities and towns that are in the same boat as we are.
Okay, but I mean, like, you know those people on the Hill
I think at some point the Senate, and I'm not picking sides here, the Senate addressed some of these concerns or looked at to address some of these concerns, just discussion on the millionaire tax. It comes down to a funding issue.
Because this would be a wholesale change in how charter schools are funded.
And I think that you would have to... For the most part, it's how education is funded. What you would do, though, you would look at making sure those lines get fully funded.
Well, we're going to have to pick that conversation up again more. But we're talking about Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. He's here live with us in the studio. Call him with your questions at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Cheryl, who's calling from Bridgewater. You're on the air, Cheryl.
Hi. I want to thank you, first of all, for taking my phone call. And I just have a quick question. I know that with Boston being a very prominent city, offering so much higher education, that a lot of the colleges enter into what they call pilot programs, which are payment in lieu. And something I don't understand is that a lot of the colleges don't even pay, or they don't meet the requirement of what they have obligated themselves to pay. My other question is, very quickly, is why can't some of these funds, because this relates to students using the infrastructure in the city, why can't some of these funds go towards funding the MBTA, such as capital projects and things like that?
Cheryl, I'm going to take it back from you if you don't mind, because a great couple of questions. Let me turn it back to the mayor.
The first answer to that question is a voluntary program. Because they're nonprofits. If we start to look at nonprofits, and I've been in politics for 20 years, I was a legislator for nearly 17 and mayor now for 3. This question would always come up every 4 or 5 years. It's kind of, where do you draw the line in forcing nonprofits who have property to pay taxes, and what churches and what religions and what schools and what education? Everyone seems to always talk about when they talk about pilot programs. Well, Harvard has an endowment of $20-30 billion, and but on the other side of the coin, we have other colleges that don't have UMass Boston or somebody or Bunker Hill, Roxbury Community College.
But you individually negotiate those pilots with the individual schools.
We are individually negotiating the pilots with those schools. I wish that some of the schools would some of the schools pay voluntary without a problem, and others we have to chase a bit. As far as the MBTA, the city of Boston makes, I believe it's a $78 million a year payment to the MBTA for services in the city. So I think that indirectly, some of the money for the MBTA comes through the taxpayers of the city of Boston. So I guess you can say sometimes indirectly, some of the pilot payments will go indirectly through.
Well, let's turn to Debbie, who's calling from Dorchester. You're on the air, Debbie.
Yeah. Hi. I was just wondering, you know, he's saying that Boston needs more funding, but yet they went ahead and gave GE a huge tax break to move to Boston.
Yeah, let me just jump on that, Debbie. Thank you. We didn't give GE any money. Basically, what happened was General Electric...
We gave them a break.
The tax break. General Electric, which is going to be worth hundreds of millions of dollars to our economy, real estate economy, right now, is we offer them a $25 million incentive from the city. Up to $25 million. The very first time they came back to Boston, they gave us $25 million of donations to our schools, and they gave $25 million donation to other entities. So $50 million investment all right off the top.
To be perfectly honest, GE is a mega super corporation. That's kind of chump change.
GE wasn't coming to Boston if we didn't work on something. And the deal that they work with us is a lot less than what was offered in other parts of the country, in New York and other places. And no one can argue to me that bringing GE to Boston is a bad thing, because it's about including more tax revenue coming into our city. So as far as helping us, it helps us bringing companies like General Electric into Boston to build our tax base, so Debbie, we can do additional investments in our schools. And over the last 3 years, I've made a $90 million investment in our schools since I've been mayor of the city of Boston. So we have gone up in the funding every single year.
Let's take a question here from Twitter. We've got a tweet from Kanan Thiruvengada. Kanan is tweeting, given the threat of sea level rise, when are we going to stop waterside development? He lives in East Boston.
I don't necessarily think that waterside development is threatening sea level rise. I think that if you're a developer and you're developing there, you have to really think about really, really long and hard about what type of development you want to put there. It's more the question, I think. In certain areas, we're looking at, the developers have looked at, they've built some protections into their building over in Charlestown. The Spalding Rehab Building is built on stilts. As literally, if the tide rises, the building could rise. They've changed some of the way that they've some buildings have changed some of the way that where they've put the utilities and stack them in different places. I think that you know, we're working every single day on sea level rise, but I don't think it's the development on the water, on the harbor. That's going to, the loss there will be the developer's loss.
Well, we're later this week, we're going to take a closer look again at Boston's readiness and resiliency regarding global warming and climate change. Let's bounce around here a little bit, Mr. Mayor, because as the mayor of a major American city, you have to be the master of many things. So I'm going to ask you about the ballot question in November that would legalize marijuana in Massachusetts. Oh. Now, you are opposed to
that. I'm opposed to that.
Yeah, a WBUR poll that we just released yesterday found that at this moment, 50% of likely voters would approve it compared to 45% opposed. So it seems like at least right now there's a bit of a gap. I mean, how do you think you're going to win people over to voting no?
That's a tough ballot question. A lot of people are all over the place with it. I mean, I view it as smoking marijuana cigarettes and edibles. These edibles that are out there that they're being sold in Denver are the concern that people in Denver and Colorado are saying with the emergency room visits going up by 33%. And it's kind of the battle back and forth and leading young people to beginning down an addictive personalities and addictive behaviors with some of these edibles that are out there.
But the poll yesterday also found that voters think that marijuana is less harmful to a person's health than tobacco, alcohol, or even sugar.
Maybe they can think what they want, but I know that there's plenty of cases that I've seen where kids, if you go to a detox center and you ask the intake coordinator, what's the drug of choice, your first drug of choice, 9 out of 10 times they're going to say it's marijuana.
Well, let's take one more call here because we've just got about a minute or so to go. Eric, you're calling from Harvard. You're on the air. Last call with Mayor Marty Walsh.
Hi. Thank you, Mayor. We started off talking about racial tensions and the police program. I think that was an opportunity to say, you know, instead of saying, well, I don't think there's the same amount of tension, to actually listen. I don't think we're going to move forward on this issue unless we take a different approach, and let's listen to the community leaders and say, you know, if there's tension out there, if they feel there's tension out there, then we need to listen to that, and let's not dismiss it up front.
Yeah, I don't think I dismissed it. If I did, I apologize for that. Maybe I was talking about Michael's comments. I saw Michael today, as a matter of fact. Certainly, we listen to the community leaders a lot in city government, in City Hall in Boston. We've begun having race dialogues. We've applied for money to the Rockefeller Foundation to do resiliency conversations around race. We've had many dialogues. Around the city, not the actual race dialogues haven't started, but we've begun those conversations with Dr. Tia Martin, having those dialogue conversations. So certainly we do listen a lot, and we're going to continue to listen, because I agree with you, Eric. The way to move forward is by listening and by also in doing positive reaction.
Mayor, can I just keep you for 2 more minutes? Because there's just 2 more quick things. Yep. I want to ask you. Because yesterday you announced that folks struggling with substance abuse addiction can actually call the constituent hotline, the 311.
Yeah, 311 hotline. Yeah. Something that's important. We were able to tie our 311 number. That's the main number at the City Hall, into helping families with addiction. There's been a lot of talk about Mass Ave, Molina Cass Boulevard, and problems out there, and methadone and heroin. Well, we have to start to combat it, and the way you combat it is one addict at a time and try and get people into recovery.
Okay. Well, last question, because we always like to look forward into the future here at Radio Boston, because as you know, Uber launched a pilot program in Pittsburgh for self-driving cars.
Yes.
And you're launching a program to explore autonomous vehicles in Boston?
Yeah, we're exploring autonomous vehicles in Boston.
They're not legal to drive on the streets of Massachusetts, though,
no,
right?
They're not. But we're going to be looking at certain areas like parking lots and see how it works and different things like that. You know, it's very early. It's very early on in the process, and I think there's been a lot of discussions around autonomous vehicles, but nothing's really been really focused on autonomous vehicles.
Do you want to see them in Boston?
So I want to have the conversation. It seems like they're coming. It sounds like when you talk to some of these major car dealerships. Not dealerships, car manufacturers. Yeah. They're creating something, so we probably need to have the conversation, the dialogue, and let people understand what that means, what something might mean.
There's so many reasons why I'm excited for the safe development of this technology, including maybe we'll see the end of parking battles in
the
city.
That should be good.
Well, Marty Walsh is the mayor of the city of Boston. It's always great to have you. Thank you so very much. And listeners, you can continue this conversation online at Twitter. Send us a tweet at Radio Boston or on Facebook at facebook.com/Radio Boston. Thanks again, Mr. Mayor.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Patriots managed to outlast the Cardinals 23-21 in their season opener Sunday night. And over in baseball, the Red Sox continue to hang on by their fingernails to a division lead. So here to catch us up on the entire world of sports is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hi there, Bill.
Hello, Meghna.
We're going to talk about the entire world of sports in 7 minutes, I just
realized. It's going to be a quick trip.
Well, let's start actually on a serious note with the NFL's announcement today that the league is pledging $100 million on safety initiatives like researching better helmets, technological development, and then $40 million of that $100 million is going into research the health effects of concussions. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, $40 million sounds like a lot of money to me, and I'm sure it sounds like a lot of money to you.
It does.
Not a lot of money to the commissioner of the National Football League. It's the kind of money he makes in a year. So the other thing that bothers me, first of all, I don't think what they're talking about is nearly enough money. The second thing is helmets. Really? Every expert I've ever talked to has said helmets are very good at preventing fractured skulls. They're no good at preventing concussions.
Because the brain still moves
around. No matter what the helmet is, the head is going to move and the brain is going to bounce around inside the head if somebody gets hit in the head real hard, which is what happens many, many, many times to all the players in every football game. So I don't really buy this unless I'm behind, and I'll have to find some more experts to talk to about helmets, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Well, but the NFL is also establishing an independent advisory board of brain injury experts. I mean, taken together, doesn't this signal some kind of progress from the stance that the NFL had not that long ago?
You know, I'm going to agree that there's been progress at the point where they actually start removing people from games when they are flat on their face and apparently unconscious, rather than saying, no, I think he's okay. Let's let him play a little longer. Let's keep him in the game, as they did with Cam Newton last week.
Right.
Even the league is investigating this. As long as all of these people who've been hired to look at what's going on in the field and to stop the action and get people who have suffered traumatic brain injuries off the field so that they don't suffer another one in the next few minutes, as long as that system doesn't work, I'm not convinced that there's anything going on here except a public relations campaign.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you referenced what happened to Cam Newton. He's the Panthers quarterback. He was hit in the head a bunch of times.
A bunch of times. And the last time he was flat on his face on the turf.
And they said, only one of those hits was drew a penalty?
Well, yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly. And then days later, they decided maybe we better find the guy who hit him as well. And they did that. But that's not the point. The penalties aren't the point. The fine isn't the point. The point is there's a system in place, theoretically, to get that guy off the field so that he can be tested so that he can go sit in a dark room and make sure that he doesn't get hit again in the head, which is the worst possible thing that can happen to you after you have a concussion is to suffer another one.
Which does seem to be happening.
Well, it is happening. Yeah. No question about it.
Well, let's switch gears here over to the world of tennis, because last time you and I talked, we were so excited about Serena Williams, and then she lost and didn't break that major title record.
No, and of course, there is the awful fact and truth that on the other side of the net, there's always going to be somebody else who's trying to win and who didn't read the script about Serena Williams breaking the record.
But that in and of itself is always a great story.
Yeah, of course it is. Of course it is.
But I just to sort of echo what we were talking about last week, I'm going to come out and say that even though she didn't break the major title record and is still tied, well, she's tied with Steffi Graf's 22 major wins, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think that actually detracts from her greatness as one of the best to ever swing
a
racket.
No, of course not. You need to look at all the factors, such as who are these people all competing with. And there's no question that Serena Williams is among the greatest, if not the greatest, female tennis player who's ever walked the earth. Also, as far as I know, and I haven't looked at the news in the last few minutes, she hasn't retired. So she still has an opportunity to break that record somewhere down the line.
Okay, so speaking of Serena Williams, now this is a story which I'm still trying to get my own head around, because her name came up in another story, a hacking group, which forensic specialists are saying they believe have ties to Russia, this hacking group. They hacked into the database of the World Anti-Doping Agency and released medical records of several high-profile U.S. athletes, including Venus and Serena Williams and, you know, Olympic champion Simone Biles. Did we find, was there any bombshells there?
I think it was the antithesis of bombshells is what they found. That all of these three athletes that you've just mentioned had applied for the opportunity to use some of the stuff, that some of the substances that would otherwise be banned.
These are therapeutic
exemptions. Therapeutic exemptions. It happens all the time. There are many, many swimmers who claim that they have asthma, and they maybe had asthma when they were kids, and then they grew out of it, but they claim they still have it, and they find a doctor who says they still have it, and it helps them. The medication for asthma helps them swim faster, or so I've been told. The therapeutic exemption is not an unusual thing, and
are hardly bombshells. What you just described, though, it may not be unusual, but it feels wrong.
It is. Well, you know, it's the war against some drugs used by some people, right? And it's a very kind of
this
murky
is the grayest
issue.
Gray area I've ever seen you wade into,
Bill.
It's
a very gray area, and I'm very uncomfortable making judgments about this sort of thing. But I will say that the three examples that you've just brought up, they seem to me to be very, very, very short of bombshells.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the NFL, actually, in the last couple seconds that we have, because there's this ongoing protest from some NFL players during the national anthem. Of course, Colin Kaepernick in San Francisco has been doing that. We also had a couple of the Patriots raise their fists at the end of the national anthem before their game on Sunday night.
Right.
Do you think this protest shows any sign of slowing down?
It'll be very interesting to watch. I think one thing that hasn't perhaps been mentioned enough is that the protest has spread into other sports besides football. Megan Rapinoe, of course, launched her own protest, a women's professional soccer player, and took a knee. And then the following week, the people responsible for staging the game played the national anthem before the players came onto the field and thus prevented her from protesting again. It is interesting that she's white and that she said, look, the black players are taking the lead in this. I'm simply showing my support. And I'm wondering if more of that is going to happen, because that would be, to me, very encouraging, that players who don't have the direct connection to the victims of this crazy, insane violence support the players who are protesting.
Mm. Well, Bill Littlefield is host of NPR's Only a Game. You can hear him on WBUR's every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. and on Radio Boston every Wednesday as well. Bill, I'm still shaking my finger at you about all that you know, about doping or therapeutic exemptions.
It's very hard to cover all of sports in 7 minutes, especially when some of the issues are that hairy.
But we'll keep doing it every week. Thanks so much, Bill.
My pleasure. Thank you, Magna.
We'll be back. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, 13 years after he became the first defendant ever sentenced to death in a federal court in Massachusetts, Gary Lee Sampson returns to court for a new sentencing trial. Back in 2003, Sampson pleaded guilty to carjacking and stabbing two men. Jurors in the case unanimously recommended the death penalty for Sampson. But in 2011, U.S. District Judge Mark Wolf overturned that sentence because one of the jurors had lied during jury selection. Well, a new jury is now tasked with deciding Sampson's sentence, and jury selection began today in Boston Federal Court. With us now with more is Nancy Gertner. She's WBUR's legal analyst and a retired federal judge as well. Judge Gertner, good to have you back.
Nice to be here.
Okay, so tell us, what do you find most significant about the fact that Gary Lee Sampson is getting a new sentencing trial?
Well, I mean, what's significant is that there was juror misconduct. That was the basis of it. It doesn't happen very often. Typically, the moments when you hear about juror misconduct is when a juror doesn't disclose enough of their background. There's more of it today in the sense that social media has created opportunities for misconduct. Wasn't involved in the Sampson case, but that was just beginning as I left the bench. It was almost as if you had to tell jurors, you no longer had to tell them just, you know, don't buy the newspapers, don't turn on the radio. For your younger generation, you had to tell them to literally disentangle from the internet, get off of Facebook, stop tweeting.
Yeah.
And that was a problem. It was a problem in Tsarnaev, for example.
Well, so in this case, they're retrying the entire sentencing phase of Sampson's trial. And the jurors will only have two options. Right, life in prison without parole or the death penalty, since it's still a federal case.
Right.
And so, I mean, I suppose he has the right to the entire sentencing phase being retried again. But jurors once again have to be, quote unquote, death qualified.
That's right. That's right. They have to. They're asked the question of whether or not their attitudes to the death penalty would substantially impair their ability to be fair. And what that typically means is you exclude those who say, I will impose the death penalty all the time. You know, I believe in it wholeheartedly. Would be and no matter what the evidence is, I would impose the death penalty, as well as those who said, I can never vote for death. And you have to pick a jury of people in between, those for whom death is a possibility that they would consider among all the options. But that's also a range from, I could impose the death penalty and that I'd be happy to do so, to I understand that I'd have to impose the death penalty, I would be reluctant.
Mm.
And the judge is essentially picking a jury in that band.
Yeah. But I wonder, is it going to be particularly challenging to seat an entire panel here? Because, I mean, as we introduced this, Sampson admitted and pleaded guilty to the killings back in 2003. And, of course, in the subsequent 13 years, there's been so much publicity about his case. I mean, doesn't that present a challenge of finding a jurors that are both death qualified and not compromised in other ways?
That is an extraordinary challenge. I don't know whether or not there was a change of venue in the Sampson case, but that is an extraordinary issue. Again, we're seeing some of the same things we saw in Tsarnaev. And death qualification there is a range of attitudes even within death qualification. Studies have shown that people who are death qualified also are pro-prosecution, anti-mitigation, a whole host of things. And the challenge of the judge would be to select who would meet the death qualification standard, but also are not essentially death prone. Mm. I will choose the death penalty no matter what. And whether you can get, how good you are at doing that will depend on how sophisticated and probing the voir dire is.
Mm. Well, Sampson is now 56 years old. It seems as if he's suffering from liver disease, hepatitis C, and he's also got high blood pressure. And his attorneys are already arguing that the death penalty is excessive. Now, are those considerations that the jury is likely to hear and should consider in their sentencing?
The concept of mitigation is really quite broad. The defense can introduce all sorts of issues having to do with his social background, to his health condition. When you think about it, you really do want mitigation to be broad because you want the jury to figure mercy into this as well. That's really what mitigation is about. What are the kinds of considerations that should bear on mercy? So sure, they will be hearing all of that. And that is the only thing that's being tried in this case. So that's what the case would be about. I understand that they listed some 350 mitigating factors,
yeah,
and perhaps
more than 200 at least.
Yeah. So this will be about him.
Well, in the last couple minutes that we have, minute and a half or so, Judge Gertner, I do want to ask you about another case that has been grabbing the headlines today, if I can say that. It's out of Braintree. It was originally reported by Channel 5 that the police chief there ordered an audit of the department's evidence room, and the audit found that guns had gone missing as well as drugs and about $70,000. And already prosecutors have had to throw out six cases this week. So some shades there, at least in terms of evidence about, you know, the massive issue with Annie Ducan and the former state chemist who tampered with evidence. I mean, what does this feel like every couple of months, you and I are talking about more problems with evidence.
Well, the takeaway, it seems to me, there are two things. One is, of course, what you do about these cases and whether or not we've always regarded that the cure, the remedy for misconduct of this sort is to dismiss the charges because the government can't be complicit in tainted evidence. The other takeaway may be a wider question about the drug war. What is it about stores of drugs and money, which is what drug prosecutions generate, that lead to this kind of conduct? You don't find, you know, the tainting of handwriting exemplars, but you do find issues of people, as the woman in Western Mass, you know, tasting the product. So should that get, is that part of the discussion, the wider discussion about the drug war?
And this, you were referencing Sonia Farag.
Sonia Farag, that's
Amherst,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, Nancy Gertner is a retired federal judge, and she's a current Harvard Law School professor and WBUR's legal analyst as well. Judge Gertner, always good to talk with you.
Nice to be here.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.